listening to the Star Wars Weekly Podcast.
And welcome to the 25th episode of the Star Wars Weekly Podcast, where each week, my friends, Adam, Grant, and myself, Ben, talk about the week in Star Wars news and many other Star Wars-related ideas, themes, and theories. This week, we're going to kick it off with Grant and Core World News. We will do our comics update, and then we are going to do the first in a series of eight, I believe, episodes going through The Hero with a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell, a Star Wars investigation, I guess is what you'd call it. I don't know.
Sounds good.
But so with no further ado, Grant, what is the Core World news?
Lots coming from the Core Worlds. We'll start with a wild rumor alert, which is there's a reported leak of a scene wherein Kerry Russell is acting opposite of Adam Driver for about a four-day shoot period. There's rumors that there's green screen, that there's starship construction, there's even a cockpit, and it's even the source is even saying that Kerry Russell is seated in the cockpit for the majority of that scene. So kind of interesting. We can feel free to speculate about it, or we can move on. It's up to you guys. I don't know.
Let us speculate.
I mean,
I love this. This sounds so cool.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I don't know. I mean, just anyone interacting with Kylo other than Rey is cool, especially a new character. Mm-hmm. I love these scenes where, like, you already know what they look like. The head-on shot in the cockpit. You've seen them film before. They're shaking. It's on like some animatronic base or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, this could be. They could be in a starfighter,
right.
Like, you know, some sort of fight, a war in the stars, if you will,
right.
In starfighters. They could be communicating at that. Like, that sounds so exciting and so original. Yeah. I'm in.
Yeah, and the source. I should interrupt and say the source also says that it could be a possible escape scene. So.
Oh,
that's kind of where it's all directed.
I love
there.
That too.
Which is fascinating because escape can mean so many different things. Yeah. There,
escape with,
right?
Escape
right?
To.
Escaping from the rebellion or escaping from the First Order is this you know, who knows? I'm still in that weird phase where I'm in somewhat denial. Is not quite the right word. Denial is a negative thing, but I haven't really quite. My brain hasn't been able to process the fact that they're shooting a new Star Wars movie, and like the ultimate Star Wars movie, and not ultimate meaning the best, but literally like the last in the saga. Like, and so when I hear these things, my brain still has to go like, this is real. This is really happening. This isn't a fever dream or like a coma dream. like this is really something that we might see. Cause again, it's still at that moment of who knows what'll actually end up in the movie at the end. But like, I'm not quite there. Like I'm trying to speculate and my brain can't quite get there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's also being reported that Kerry Russell's codename is Mara, but I mean, there's no way she's playing Mara Jade. It's simply a troll, right?
Yeah. It's JJ messing with
it. Physically can't happen. I mean, he could just call her that, but as an ultimate troll, that would probably burn more bridges than he would hope to do.
That would backfire tremendously.
So we know Black Squadron might be coming back into the picture. Do we think Kerry Russell could be a member of Black Squadron, or would that kind of defy the logic of the comic? Like, do you think they could add her in, or
could she be a character in Black Squadron?
She totally could. Why not? Like, especially if we're going to do a time jump.
I'm trying to think because there are like female like.
Characters
that would fit her demographic.
I mean, she could be. I mean, honestly, if the Poe Dameron's going anywhere, she could be. You know, I'm horrible with names. I just read the comic like an hour ago.
Right.
Zap.
Yes.
Wexley's wife.
Right.
Or
Nora Wexley.
Nora Wexley's the mother.
Snap Wexley's got
Snap Wexley's
wife. I didn't
wife or girlfriend.
Right. Because she's on Black Squadron.
And featured heavily in the comics currently in the Poe Dameron comics.
Maybe that. Yeah.
Or just a new Black. I mean. People die in starfighters all the time.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we're going to need more black whatever numbers you have. Definitely. So she could just be a new member of Black Squadron.
Yeah, well, while we're on the topic of rumors and speculations, there's also speculation that Episode 9 could be divided into two parts after the success of Infinity War.
Yeah.
Do you guys have thoughts on that?
Yep.
Yeah, no?
Please, God, no. Under my breath wasn't clear enough. No.
Yeah, that's an easy no, right? Like, let's just keep to the formula. It's such a big production, and we love the way that...
You get 2.5 hours, it's plenty. Yeah. Just do it.
Grant, I saw this like last week. Do we know where these rumors are coming from?
No, I just decided to throw that out there.
No, and I think it's worth, because it's getting a lot of plays. Yeah. I think it's worth there. I just feel like someone was going to make this claim or make this a possibility, because this is the era we live in. Every final movie in a series is inevitably split into two, right? Harry Potter, The Hunger Games, you can go on and on. Yeah. Yeah. They're trying to do it like the Allegiance movies, but those failed so horribly. I think they're doing a double one on Netflix or something. And then like...
Well, last season of Game of Thrones, really.
Last season of Game of Thrones. And Grant, you mentioned Avengers Infinity Wars. Yes, there's going to be more Marvel movies after that, but that seems to be kind of the culmination of 10 years of that plot. So,
right.
Like, yeah, I can't imagine what happened, because just my math brain, like my number obsessed brain, freaks out because we're going to call it episode 9 and episode 10 because that annoys
episode
me.
Episode 9.5, and that's a little like cheap.
9.1, episode 9.
I think it would be
9
and 10. Yeah.
Yeah, right? Like that's what I have to do.
I've seen a lot of people online kind of clamoring for that, being like, I think there should be a 10th episode, and it'll, I mean, we all. I always want more.
I
just feel like there should be some symmetry here. And
agree. That's the thing. Trilogies. There should be three trilogies. And I know that is me just hanging out to it. If there's going to be an episode 10, do an episode 10 10 years from now. We're coming back to one more that where's everyone now or something like that. Yeah, but I also don't want to wait another 2 years. seems like how much, I don't know. I was going to say like how much are you just going to be like spinning your wheels? But again, I could easily sit with another 4.5-5 hours in this era this universe. So,
I think we're all in agreement about that.
Yes, agreed. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd like to argue the opposite side just for giggles, because yes, I do like,
Right.
You know, I do like more movies than less movies, but I think that's really it. It's my own selfish thing where it's like, no, I've been waiting for this my whole life. Can we just actually put a bow on this thing?
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Wrap up the Skywalker saga and then
just to make sure I don't die before that.
Right. And then, I know. Like, I'm holding on by a thread. Like, every year it's less and less likely I'm going to make it to another Star Wars movie. But it's just like, we've talked about this in the past. That doesn't mean it's the last we've seen of these characters. There can be another movie with Finn and with Rey, but wrap up the Skywalker saga in 9 as we were been promised since. Pretty much my birth.
Right.
Yeah.
And we didn't get the mic drop reveal that we got in Empire, so the mystery is still hanging, you know? And so I would just say let's resolve it in 9 in one movie, because we've left the mystery hanging for 2 movies now. We still kind of don't know where Rey comes from and if what Kylo was saying is completely credible.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. But we'll jump to the next topic. Excerpt from the Solo novelization by Mer Lafferty was posted on StarWars.com. The excerpt gives us a glimpse into one of Han's early missions for the Imperial Navy that is pursuing headhunters with Onyx Squadron. Han's call sign was Onyx 9 for future trivia dates. Han takes a risk to save Onyx 2, Cadet Lighten Dree. Kind of cool name. He has no choice but to crash land a Star Destroyer after making this maneuver. He's then held in front of an Imperial tribunal. Tag and Bink are featured. There's a really cool droid in there. And then he's obviously transferred to Mimban as punishment for that action.
Wait, so he was piloting a Star Destroyer?
No. He was in a starship, just a single action fighter.
Oh, I thought you said that...
Lands in a Star Destroyer, in the hangar bay of a Star Destroyer, but botches it and crash lands inside the bay. Yeah,
that sounds like our boy.
Yeah. It'll be cool to hear some Tag and Bink dialogue and see all that kind of stuff going on. That's really cool.
And more of Han as an Imperial cadet, I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, the droid MGK-300 is really cool, too. Mm-hmm. In the comic, it's kind of a funny, interesting droid. But you guys thinking you're going to buy the book based on that excerpt?
I'll get it from my local library, probably.
Yeah. Let's check it out. Yeah.
I will probably wait to hear Grant's synopsis.
That's true.
I always buy the novelizations. That is true.
I know, because I know you always do. I've bought them, and I haven't read them. Mm. I don't know. I hold on to them for like if I'm going to be away on business and I have nothing going on or on a long plane ride or something and be like, all right, I'll dip into this. But I don't know. I need to see something new, I think.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It'll just make me want to watch the movies.
And that's the thing. And I'm interested in this one, similar to interested in Rogue One, which I never actually read. Mm-hmm. Just because any of these movies that had kind of a lot of editing done, a lot of versions, you get a lot of those kind of additional scenes in the novelization. To be honest, the more I think about it, I'll probably wait. I'll probably, once I've gotten through all the other ones, maybe I'll work my way through the novelizations. I'll wait for the comic adaptation because I feel like I get a lot more out of it. I'm more likely to read that, and I feel like with the Rogue One adaptation, I'm looking forward to what they do with Solo.
And after reading the Last Jedi novel, comic book adaptation, some really beautiful art in there that I'm really glad I took part in.
Right.
That reading process was really, really fun.
But the story isn't.
Nothing's really added. Yeah. There's some internal thoughts from
it
that are kind of cool.
It's interesting.
But predictable and understandable to a degree that doesn't challenge you, but it's fun. It's really
fun. Very similar to the Force Awakens adaptation. It was very just what was on screen was in that, but a different visual version of it.
The adaptation I liked the most actually was Return of the Sith. Did you guys read that?
Yes.
Back in the day?
Yeah.
That was the first one to catch my eye. Yeah. I was like, oh, I should. And then it sort of really showed me the depth of the characters. Because I think it took me a while to sort of wrap my head around that movie and just be like, wait, why did he switch to the dark side?
Right,
like,
right.
You know, as painful as it was. And then that cleared it up for me a lot. But I don't know. But since then, new canon, I don't know. I just haven't.
I'm the same. I think I've read the novelization of the prequel trilogies, and that's the last ones I read. And they did a good job. I mean, they made me appreciate the prequel movies a lot more, I think.
I went back and ended up reading all of those. And then actually Lucino's Plagueis fits nicely.
Totally. Well, that wraps us up for Core World News. I did want to talk about Episode 9 titles for a second, if you guys have any new ones. I put a little poll up on the Twitter. I put up kind of my new favorite title, which is A New Alliance. I really like this title a lot. It actually won out on the poll, which is really cool.
Nice.
It was next.
What were the other options?
It was next to the
Garbage Space.
Yeah, exactly. It was Garbage Space
junk.
9. Babylon Z. A new Alliance. The New Order. Spark of Hope. Tried to think of an R word, like Revenge of the Sith or Return of the Jedi, restore, I don't know, something, but Reign of Darkness, I thought would kind of could work, right?
Yeah.
But Reign of Darkness,
that'd be quite a note.
Reign of Darkness was kind of a Kylo angled thing, and then Spark of Hope was angled to Rey, right? But those were kind of no one really liked those that much. It was the New Order and New Alliance really got a lot of votes.
You had texted us earlier in the week with that idea with the New Alliance, and I think last week I said A New Hope, and I'm just gonna I think I mentioned last week, like, I'm just sticking with it because
A new order, right?
That was new order. A new order.
Yeah.
Okay. Both of you guys utilizing the new.
A new. I feel like there's something cyclical about that, this beginning and end type of thing.
Right.
But I think saying I'm going to stick with mine, I think I prefer Grant's. Like, I want to be right because I want to be right, but if I had a choice between which one of those two were going to actually be it, I'd go with Grant's choice, I think.
A New Alliance is kind of meta, right? It kind of pertains to, like, what Kylo and Rey discovered in their relationship in The Last Jedi, which is kind of fun.
It can mean a lot of different things. Yeah.
I also threw up a little poll about Thrawn. I said, you know, when we look at the sleek tech of First Order, Kylo's TIE silencer, and the fact that Snoke has loyal Hyperlane observers, it seems plausible that Thrawn may have had a hand in the Imperial Renaissance. Could it make sense for Thrawn to appear in Episode 9?
Mm-hmm. What did they say?
Most people said no, too much to introduce. I said the answers I gave people were either no, it's all about Reylo, yes, he'd enhance Reylo, no, Kylo is the big bad, no, too much to introduce. I only use the word Reylo because I can't really fit that into the poll answer. Rey and Kylo Ren. So,
understood. You can use
too much to introduce. A lot of people said too much to introduce.
As much as we've seen him, it's not, you know, it won't have the effect on people to be like, who's the blue guy? In the movie.
Yeah, it makes sense.
I'd like it. I'd be okay with it, but I think I agree with the results.
That said, there's a way to do it.
Sure.
I mean, you could reintroduce Thrawn and sort of, you know, maybe it starts with Thrawn coming out of the, you know, out of the outer regions, the unknown regions, and suddenly we have this, you know, 5 minutes of character development on him before we get to everybody else.
I almost wanted to post our texts that we were sending back and forth about Thrawn and his state after he comes out of the unknown region, how he could be a little warped and not so smug with his talents. It might be really fun to have him be a little different than we've seen him before.
Totally.
Right, cool. We had talked about, like, I mean, because there's something that Thrawn is seeking, right? Like, he has an agenda that's not... that's much further beyond what his current... He has the at-hand agenda, whatever mission he is, and he's always thinking about that. But you always feel like he's playing 3D chess, right? And so every move he makes for the immediate have influence or influences things far in the future. And, and it has something to do with the Chiss Ascendancy, his people, but we don't know what that is. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. So maybe that would be the thing. Like... it would make sense to culminate it in 9. I mean, if you don't do it there, you can't do it at all, really.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know, unless you want to have your own, his own trilogy or something. Maybe it's a Thrawn movie trilogy, and it's about the Chiss Ascendancy infiltrating. Maybe they're the villains, and they're the ones that attack the, the galaxy.
Right. And I guess, and for all we know, this is something that could have happened in the 35 years between, Return of the Jedi and Force Awakens. Like, we don't know, it could have been an outside threat and the new, that they dealt with, which it feels weird, right? Like, it'd feel like that'd be a major epic thing to happen in the middle of everything. And I guess it just feels like because
that's not on the radar,
like, nothing happened,
or the major characters that we know.
And so it'd be a weird kind of just trying to fit it in.
I think it would have to be something after.
I would agree. Yeah.
Then you could introduce, like, who's the new, what is the word I'm trying to think of? A Republic.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, who runs the New Republic? Yeah. The Chancellor. Who are the Freedom Fighters? Who are the Champions? What's the New Jedi Order?
Right.
You know, again, you could do it like 10 years after that.
And right.
Like, finally, the Chiss Ascendancy rears its head, and you have all these new characters and plots, and that would be really exciting.
Yeah. I would say if there's any legitimacy to the rumors that they're going to split into two movies, if there's an announcement that they're splitting into two movies, I would double down on bets of Thrawn appearing, because my thought is that's why they would split it into two, is because of that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they're going to split into, and I don't think they're going to introduce Thrawn.
He's gotten a lot of exposure with Rebels and then the Thrawn Alliance's book.
Yeah.
To the point where it would be a nice fit for him to come in and take over the First Order post this last trilogy, because we have the theme park coming out, and it might be more immersive if the war is kept on going. And it's Thrawn who's overseeing everyone at that theme park, and who's being like Big Brother, and who's being this control freak. You know, I mean, that might be really fun in my opinion.
Can I break in with a theme park update? Because I read something online today, which I am maybe so freaking excited, and I forgot to talk about it. But like, this would be real quick. Apparently, there's going to be a Millennium Falcon ride, and that you actually are doing space battles. And it's similar to other ones they've done in other parks, where you actually, it's like an interactive video game, and you get scores by the end. Like, you get a point. And apparently, the point is connected somehow to something you're wearing. And so when you go in the cantina, the interactive people treat you differently depending on how you did in that mission. Like, you're either a hero, or you're just kind of like, look at this, like loser. Like, so, sorry.
Just what I
That's
need,
all.
More people to tell me, like, what a loser I am.
I know, right? Like, I know.
That's just cool. That I really like that.
Yeah, sorry. Just need to break in with that, because I just read that today, and I'm like, that sounds incredible.
So you kind of get to write your bio in the Star Wars galaxy based on your performance in these rides.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Yeah. Really like that. Cool. That's it for Core World News. Cool. So we can move on to comic news.
Can I do a quick video game update after my tirade? You guys are both flinching right now.
Everything is fixed, and it's the perfect game.
So no.
Everything's bolted down right now.
No. It's actually better. I went and visited. They have a double experience points weekend last weekend. Mm-hmm. So of course, me being who I am, couldn't help myself and buffed out, got like perked out all my cards for all my heroes. And actually had a really good time. Those glitches that I was experiencing before are resolved themselves for the most part. Okay. They don't happen as much. But there's still like ping sites. Like, no one in Australia can play the game right now because of those issues. Palpatine's back in the game. Oh. They put him back in. It's kind of boring. It needs more stuff. There's not enough people working on it. They're starting to communicate more. Forge, who's the Ben something or other is his name.
He's the community manager.
Cool. He's been saying more things, and so they're gonna release a new hero a month, I think, starting in the fall. Mm-hmm. just to try and spread it out, I guess.
All right.
But that's that. So things are happening. I'm going to get you two guys to play with me someday soon just because.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a thing. It's beautiful, and it's completely underwhelming at the same time. And that is the state of Star Wars games.
Clone Wars Jedi, which Jedi do you want them to add first, besides Anakin and Obi-Wan?
Oh, which of Jedi that fought in the Clone Wars?
Yes, yes.
I gotta go Qui-Gon.
Okay.
All right. I mean, I know he's like, he's not really in the
Clone
movies.
Wars, but yeah, yeah.
Oh, you're right. You're right. Yeah, yeah. You're right. I'm sorry. I mean, but he's...
he fits. You're right. Fine. I would allow it.
Force Ghost.
Qui-Gon.
Qui-Gon. OP. Just like shooting lightning bolts.
Just game crashing.
All the blasters just go straight through.
It would have to be Mace Windu, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Mace I don't know. I mean, unless you're a big Ki-Adi Mundi.
I was going to say Ki-Adi Mundi.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe some Plo Koon.
I need some emotes from Ki-Adi Mundi.
Yeah.
I'm set after that.
Yeah.
He would be really funny. I remember playing him in the original.
All day long.
Just neck swiping. Sorry. My God.
That would be great. Yeah. He would be. I mean, but that's something they would do because they like to pick these esoteric characters and make them amazing. Like Greedo in 2015's version was so good. And Bossk is like OP.
Bossk is OP. Everyone picks Bossk, huh?
Yeah, because he can just take over any sort of point. The thing I'm looking forward to most out of this next generation, what they're doing, is they're doing conquest modes. So it's sort of like instead of this sort of like chained along thematic story in the game, they're going to just be like, you know, it'll be like Supremacy or something where sort of capture a point and it's a really open world. And I think that would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
Just because it needs more modes. There's not enough game modes in the game. It's kind of boring.
Yeah.
Speaking of Bossk. Mm-hmm. Is he featured in the new comic that we're about to talk about?
He is not, but a good segue. We'll move into the comics part of the show. Two new comics this week, one ongoing, which is Poe Dameron, number 31, Charles Soule, who's just like killing it. Mm-hmm. I tagged him in one of my posts on Instagram, and he liked it, which made me feel very, very happy. Cool. But he's just doing such a great job on the Vader. Mm-hmm. And Poe Dameron's so good as well. I'm a little sad because I believe this is the penultimate issue of the series. Oh, wow. I know it's ending soon, and at the very end it said to be concluded. And for some reason I thought it was going to 32, but it might be going to 31. So maybe there's a little button on the end. Mm-hmm. You know, another just kind of single issue that kind of ties everything together. And then the other one, Grant, that you're referring to was standalone Beckett, the one-shot Beckett comic. Which is a lot of fun. I was able to get the variant.
Love that cover, by the way.
The cover.
Gorgeous.
He's standing there in his Imperial
fatigue.
Yep. Criminal, Empire outfit, which is looking good.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Jerry Duggan, another kind of a stalwart there with the comics, with the Star Wars comics, does a really good job. It's a fun read. It's doesn't add a lot to the mythos of the characters. It's really just it's Beckett, Val, and Rio. And it seems to be occurring probably directly, it's unclear, but probably directly before the events of Solo. Like, this is how they kind of got
to. He was working for the Empire for too long before. Like, he seemed like they were just infiltrating the Empire to get that vehicle. So.
Yeah. And it does a lot to build out those characters that we lose pretty quickly in the beginning of Solo. So it's a good kind of prequel to it a little
cough,
bit.
Cough, Val, cough.
Yes.
Yeah.
Pretty much. And so it's we get a little and bit Rio, of, you get some of the other characters. I won't give a lot away, but you get some of the other characters from Solo popping in and kind of explaining some of the character or some of the relationships we see between them. But they don't build out like we were hoping they would kind of do. You would see Bossk because Bossk was name checked. Yeah. We might get the Aurra Sing moment. Yeah. We don't get either of those in the issue. So I want to temper expectations. But definitely a fun read. It's a long one too. It's actually three parts. It's a maxi series. It's probably like 45 pages or so. Lots of fun.
It looks humongous.
It is. It's larger than
just one issue though.
That's it. Just standalone. Cool. But three. It's fun because they do it in three chapters with three different artists. So that's always fun.
Oh,
Salazar
really?
Lamming and Sliney, I think. And I apologize if I'm I apologize that I am mispronouncing names because I always do.
Yeah.
But good artwork all around. Lots of fun. really kind of builds up those characters. Poe Dameron, I don't want to say a lot there, but again, we're in the plot where it is happening concurrently with The Last Jedi. Black Squadron is still looking for people to come help. As you can probably guess, based on The Last Jedi, things don't go well for them. But kind of this one was a bit of a heartbreaker in some ways that I won't say more than that. But I was reading it and going, I'm enjoying this. And then I'm like, wait, no, this is depressing. So have fun. But there's still one more issue. So it could be, right, you know, in the Star Wars, it's darkest before the dawn.
I was going to say.
Yep. So lots of fun. Can't wait to see where they're going again. And I think at the end of the Beckett, they did announce that they're doing the solo novelization or the solo adaptation starting in October. So we'll get those in a couple months starting around. So
interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. Very cool.
Awesome.
Yeah. Good week.
All right. And now we're going to move on to the first chapter. We're actually going to start with a prologue of Hero with a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell. We're just going to run this up in case any of you are not familiar. This was a massively influential book in the late 60s. Early 70s, actually.
The first edition was released in late 40s, but I think the big one that kind of hit was a lot of revision. They released a revised edition in 68, so we're actually right at the 50-year anniversary of the book.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Of the cool major revision.
Just like we planned it.
Exactly.
50-year year retrospective. I just remember, I just know my dad was huge into it, and
yeah.
As I watched Star Wars, obviously a lot as a young person, my dad was like, I bet that George Lucas read A Hero of a Thousand Faces. My dad was a, you know, high school English teacher,
yeah,
and he was very much into this. And sure enough, it came out later that, like, indeed, it was massively influential. And I mean, really, if you you know, if you look at A New Hope, is almost the instantiation of the book.
Yeah. And George Lucas had a one-on-one mentorship with Joseph Campbell. So
really,
yeah. Oh, I did not know that.
Yes, yeah.
Oh,
and
wow.
And Joseph Campbell came to Skywalker Ranch numerous times, and George had met with him numerous times, and so a lot of contact between both those storytellers.
That's fantastic and encouraging. And I mean,
yeah,
and it was like, that's the kind of collaboration that creates a movie series that changes lives, right?
Yeah.
It's a phenomenal book. It's very interesting, and it's so this is really at the roots of everything that makes Star Wars good. So
exactly. Yeah.
I hadn't read it in a million years, and so we thought it would be an original thing.
Yeah.
To go through it in the context of Star Wars. So we're going to do it. So we mentioned it at the end of last week's podcast, and maybe you read it, maybe you didn't. We're going to start with the monomyth this week, and then next week we're going to get on to part one, The Adventure of the Hero.
Yeah.
So we'll do that.
Probably just chapter one of part one, right?
Yes, chapter one of part one.
Because
that's 30 pages. I'm not reading 170 pages of this before next week. I'm just saying that right now.
Yeah, honestly, oh my goodness, yeah.
10 pages of this is really dense. Yeah,
it took me almost, I mean, granted I had a dog licking my face the whole time, and I'm going to use that as my excuse, but it took me almost like 2.5 hours to read 30 pages.
Yeah, it took me a while, especially because everyone at Starbucks wanted to stop by and say, I love that book, I read that book in college, it was hilarious. I was just like, I read a ton at Starbucks, and I never get this, and this is the one where I was just like, come on. I literally took the slipcover off.
Yeah.
About halfway through, because every time I'd be getting into it, someone would stop by, and I'm like, I'm not doing the thing at Starbucks where I'm trying to get attention. I just can't be in my house anymore.
The thing is, and it's working.
Wearing earphones, they're still talking to me.
Yes. But, yeah. Sorry. There's only two parts to this book, but yes, there's six chapters with an epilogue and a prologue. So prologue's first. Chapter one, The Departure, will be next week. So let's get into it. What do you guys think about the book? What are your thoughts?
It's dense. It's real dense. It's fascinating. Of the three of us, I think I'm the only one at this table who's never actually read this book, which is somewhat surprising considering that my area that I study is the social sciences, mostly sociology, but I wasn't a psychology major in undergrad.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that's the stuff's a little ubiquitous, meaning that you kind of if engaged with this, whether or not you've read this book, you know the monomyth, you know these ideas if you've dealt with any type of literature or you know, sci-fi or fantasy movies, right?
Like right, because it's been repeated a million times.
Yes.
What I never knew until reading this book and literally like the first page, I'm like, Oh, wow. He is a Freudian psychologist. Like, yeah. This is all Freudian.
Yeah. And,
like,
yes. And Jungian.
And Jungian, yeah. And psychoanalysis, yes. And connection to dream analysis.
Is everything.
Is everything. And what I'll say is, for someone who is not a big fan of Freudian psychology and psychoanalysis, this first part actually made me appreciate it a little more because it was taken away from... Because it's Jungian more than Freudian, right? It's less about the individual in a lot of ways and more about culture, right? Exactly. And those cultural touchstones that are universal, which I think is so important these days to understand that, you know, yes, we have a lot of different cultures, but there's a lot more in the same between cultures and they're different, right? I think.
And actually, really how appropriate for right now,
too. Right? Like, that's the thing. So I really took that away and it was fun in a weird way of feeling like I'm back in grad school. And it took me a while to not just keep underlining the main parts of his argument because that's I'm used to having to write a summary and go like no, I'm only going to try to underline, make notes of things that I think connect to Star Wars.
To Star Wars.
Right, and that's what I try to do with this read as well. But I thought it was really fun when he did go through all the different psychologists and their points of view about the archetypal images, and they all had the same thought about this, that there's psychological dispositions that naturally occur in our social structure. There's these archetypes, right? There's these primal psychic characters that then we dream about, and then we use myth to try to answer some of those problems in those dreams with these characters, right? And that's kind of super, super fascinating. But back to like just the basic structure of the hero's journey. And I haven't read this book since film school, and at that, like Screenwriting 101 was kind of the first time I picked this up. But the hero's journey is just so different across, you know, all the different kind of media and ways about thinking it. There's a lot of different ways to think about it. There's kind of a screenwriting approach, which is like setup, complication, resolution. There's like the Aristotelian approach, which is like the setup, confrontation. Or I guess it's the same. It's very similar. So I would say the Aristotle approach is kind of what screenwriters more move to, whereas Campbell is more of like a spiritual journey. Kind of myths are like clues to our spiritual nature and exploring. There's a really deep kind of spiritual catharsis in myths that's really interesting, and screenwriting kind of dulls it down, dumbs it down, adds in plot points and twists and turns and things like that. But the hero's journey is the essence, and that's where it all comes from. So it's really fun to go back to Campbell, talk about the hero's journey in relation to Star Wars.
But I'm not saying anything that hasn't been said before, but I mean, movies and comics and things like that are a modern myth, right? It's not it's not the same thing, but they're trying to achieve the same ideas. It's a way of processing things that are bigger than the individual that we can. And, you know, there's a reason why Star Wars connects with so many people, especially the first, you know, the original three, right? I always jokingly talk about if there was an apocalyptic thing and I had a kid and I was telling kids stories by the campfire, the stories of like heroes and morals would be the original trilogy, because it hits those same touchstones that every other myth in human history hits.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's really the essence of it. If you haven't read this book and we're sort of prattling on about all these things, what the monomyth is, I mean, what it says, monomyth, one myth, it's essentially... His focus is to take look at all of the myths across as many cultures as he could find, across as many religions as he can find, and see what connects them and see how they're the same. And it turns out they're very, very similar. And so he's distilled it down into this core, as we're going to go see the hero's journey. But so in this first prologue, he's really giving the 20,000-foot view of where this comes from. Yeah. And it's interesting because it's not just from these cultures. He looks at it all sort of cross-referenced through dreams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the psychoanalysis of dreams.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. And specifically Freudian, which I don't really know anything about Freud except for what everyone else does, the sort of Oedipal complex sort of thing.
Yeah.
Love your mother, kill your father. I think he calls it the triad or the tragicomic triangle of the nursery.
Yeah.
And I don't really know anything about Jungian theory either, except for what he says there. So I'll be learning as we go through this, but what he says makes sense.
Yeah.
It's sort of like in the beginning of your life, you're trying to rectify the tragedy of birth and you know, find love, and then you're trying to deal with death after that.
And I think an important thing to kind of get at that I was just thinking right now, because I was rolling my eyes a lot when Ben was saying things about dream analysis and stuff. but that's just my own personal belief about this stuff.
Right.
Yeah. But what I think what I'm going to have to keep reminding myself and our listeners that we're doing is not necessarily saying that what he's saying is accurate or true, but reminding ourselves that we're doing this from a view of Star Wars and what George Lucas took out of it. And George Lucas at least believes that this stuff is important and connects with humans, right? And so that's the thing where I kept kind of go back of whether or not I believe in an Oedipal complex doesn't matter, but what can we see? Did Lucas take anything away from that? You know, things like that. So I'm going to try to keep my eye rolling and my guffawing to a minimum when it connects back to some of the stuff that I don't agree with.
We should put it, I mean, because it's interesting because what we're doing is what did Lucas take from this?
Right, exactly.
And it's interesting out of that, like just the Jungian triad, like it says like you have a natural rivalry with your father.
Right.
And I mean, that's the core of the thing. Yeah, I mean, that was one note I have here. It was when they sort of, Young points out that like each one of these psychologists, all of them sort of believe the same thing.
Yeah.
But it's all premised on the fact that dreams are a direct tap to your subconscious.
Right.
Yes. Which is like, I don't know if that's been scientifically proven. I mean, it makes sense that that's sort of what's kicking around in there, but I mean, it could also not be. You know,
It's still a very, very specific, and I'll say, I don't know if valid's the wrong word, because valid, again, assumes scientific validity. But yeah, it's still a very popular part of psychology. And there is, I mean, I think we can all agree that there is things going on in our subconscious mind. And that some dreams, when you have them, you're like, oh yeah, I know exactly why I had that dream. Like you can connect it to your brain processing things. Other things are just sometimes a cigar is a cigar, a duck's a duck, and that's it. But yeah, I think it's, it is fascinating to read, like, some of the stuff that connecting, like, Grant was saying, like, and Ben, you're saying, that the book actually takes literal case studies of dreams and tries to connect it back, which is interesting.
I like he talks about dreams and the subconscious as sort of like, this is the internal adventure.
Yeah.
This is the adventure that all of us have that's the closest, it's the part of myth that we own. And I have a little thing here that I think wraps that up, but he writes, the unconscious sends all sorts of vapors, odd beings, terrors, and deluding images up into the mind, whether in dream, broad daylight, or insanity for the human kingdom. Beneath the floor of the comparatively neat little dwellings that we call our consciousness goes down into unsuspected Aladdin caves.
Mm-hmm. Right.
With
jewels and gin.
Exactly. Yes. Not only jewels, but also dangerous to abide. Yep. The inconvenient or resisted psychological powers that we have not thought or dared to integrate into our lives.
Right. Yeah.
And that's actually, first of all, very poetic. Really the way beautiful. He writes.
It's really very poetic.
He has amazing prose. But it's also it's kind of a beautiful thing. Like, we know the subconscious can be dangerous because there's all these sort of unchecked, things that are lingering in our subconscious that we, allegedly the subconscious never forgets, right?
Yeah.
So it's something you think you heard a million years ago is going to actually affect, or not a million, years ago.
Yeah.
It could still be affecting you today and you're not really even thinking about doing it, but it's there. And
Or a million years ago if you're talking about Jungian psychology.
Right. Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
He also brings up a point about how the soul is kind of desiring a high adventure. And, and he talks about, and other philosophers talk about the human will to see like sublime beauty and sublime horror, and it's kind of an inescapable dilemma where we're constantly trying to find something in our imagination or our subconscious to pull from and figure out our own problems that manifest in these kind of archetypes that we see in our dreams and whatnot.
Yeah.
But I found when he first starts the chapter Myth and Dream, he talks about the hero's journey in a very overarching way, which he said it's just the story of experiencing the unknown. Yeah. And in Star Wars, I would say confronting the unknown, because there's kind of a war, right? There's context of battling, there's context of fighting, right?
Yeah.
But the first thing it gets to is kind of a psychoanalysis instead of dreams. It's about the dual unit, right?
Right.
And it's about the human. When the human is born, it's born too early. It's raw. It needs to have a relationship with the mother, the Madonna, the Bambino, right?
Right.
You immediately think Kylo and Leia, right? When we think about Star Wars and the new story.
I was actually also thinking of the prequel trilogy.
Right.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like, those come around. Like, it's you could see him coming back to this when he was writing the prequel trilogy and saying, like, oh, we didn't really touch on this in the original trilogy.
I'm sorry, what part was that?
I think right after the first paragraph or second paragraph, it gets into the dual unit, and it... it talks about the human's need for love and affection. It happens very early on. Then we jump right into the unfortunate father stuff that you brought up earlier.
Yes. Yeah. So you're talking about more about when Anakin gets separated from his mother?
Sure, exactly.
Yeah, and like the Oedipal stuff, I was trying to like my like, you know, stretch my psychological brain and be like, so what's the closest thing to we have an Oedipal complex in Star Wars? And what I came to was Anakin Padme Obi-Wan.
Right.
Relationship, right? Yeah. This idea of like wants to kill his father by episode three. Obi-Wan is his father. I mean, it doesn't quite work, but they do play up a little bit in that, which I think was probably a bigger part and then just got removed.
But symbolically works, and that's kind of all the connection we need.
Yeah.
When reading this, we realize symbols are really all that matter at the end of the day.
Right? Yeah. And you have that connection between Obi-Wan and, and Padme a little bit in episode three that feels a little like there might be something more there.
This is going to be kind of weird, but do you guys ever read like Plato's Symposium?
Years ago.
There's one I think a playwright, Aristophanes, talks about the four-legged, four-armed monster that was the early primal human that Zeus then struck with lightning bolt to split in half, and that's where kind of the idea of the soulmate comes from. You're going to try and reunite with that person to become one again.
Yeah.
And Apollo gave them faces and made them beautiful and whatnot. But he left the navel, the belly button, there, and I found it. I just looked back at The Last Jedi and thought Kylo Ren's belly button's covered in that shirtless scene. It's almost as if he's trying to deny this kind of soul search that is kind of built in the dual unit that is Rey and Kylo.
Well,
it's kind of interesting.
You know, he would agree. Nothing's by accident, right? That's the whole thing. About
I don't know if that's on purpose, though.
But that's the thing about Freudian. Yeah, right? Yeah. There's no such thing as. It's a cliche of there's no such thing as accidents. But that whether or not. What they would argue is whether or not Rian Johnson did that on a conscious level, it was unconscious, and that's what it meant.
Cool.
So that's
thing.
Exactly.
And I connected. There's so many. We were texting about it. There's so many times in the margins I just wrote TLJ, TLJ.
Yeah.
Like
First monomyth chapter is very The Last Jedi.
Yeah, and I feel like he really wanted to try to honor to Lucas in that way. You know, a lot of people feel like it doesn't, but I feel like it does because it does try to like deal with some of these themes that weren't dealt with in the previous movies, it felt like, in some ways. Which, because we have to remember, like, we've talked about this, each movie is its own story, each trilogy is its own story, and then all nine is its own story, right? And so when you're looking at this circular story arc, you're going to see repeating themes throughout it. But we are dealing with the ultimate story coming up, and we dealt with the penultimate, right? And so all these things are coming around.
Yeah.
If you had Luke come in and be the wise savior and fix everything, where the hell are you going to go in episode 9 if you're building on the monomyth?
Right.
And also, I mean, that's also, we're going to get into it probably 5 weeks from now or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I mean, there's one of the, you know, the hero has to come back from death and sort of have this understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it feels like Rian Johnson, I didn't really think of it before, but like now, Rian Johnson followed this like to the letter, this book to the letter.
Mm-hmm,
I think
he really
filled it in with a lot of this stuff because, I mean, especially, I mean, the way that he handled the Luke Skywalker. I mean, it's exactly it. Like he's still flummoxed at the end, visited by Yoda, transcends in a way almost exactly like Buddha, which is like one of the things here. Yep. And then like,
when he brings up the whole Buddhist storyline, and you think back at the Kylo Luke confrontation, you can't help but think about the Buddha.
I honestly, every time I kept flashing back, it's so funny. Like
sitting cross legged on a stone,
right?
Like
it's just like that is fully conscious decision.
Yeah.
So on page 11, I feel like there's a quote at the end that I almost feel like, and I'll just read that out in a second, that Rian Johnson just pinned up on his wall when he was writing Last Jedi.
Sure.
And it almost seems like a direct response to The Force Awakens. And it starts at the end, he goes, schism in the soul, schism in the body, social, will not be resolved by any scheme of return to the good old days, or by programs guaranteed to render an ideal projected future, or even by the most realistic, hard-headed work to weld together again the deteriorating elements. Only birth can conquer death, the birth not of the old things again, but of something new.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that is him looking at and going, we can't redo, we can't go back to that feeling of Star Wars, we can't go too far forward and kind of come up with this perfect thing. Like, we have to do something new.
Right.
But it's just, I read that, and I'm like, I just kept thinking, like, Rian Johnson.
Right.
That was his mantra going to bed at night, I feel like.
I love that quote, too. I mean, and it kind of goes on, but it, But yeah, only birth can conquer death. You mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. with something, and because it's true, it's this constant death and rebirth, death and rebirth, yes. death and rebirth.
Then not to, and then I'll, and I won't like quarterback this whole thing. Then on page 12, there's another quote where I feel like George Lucas pinned this up on his wall when he was talking about writing the new trilogy, when he released that tweet about what his episode 7, 8, 9 would be.
Oh,
about.
I know. Is it the first to start with the first step?
Yeah, go ahead. You wrote that
too. The first step, detachment or withdrawal, consists in a radical transfer of emphasis from the external to the internal world, macro to microcosm, a retreat from the desperations of the wasteland to the peace of the everlasting realm that is within. Yes. I mean, that's also Rey, right?
It is. Like, it works on it works, many levels.
It works without all the wills and world of the microcosm. And
yeah. George Lucas like that. Took that literally. Mm-hmm. Ryan Johnson and others took that figuratively.
Right. Yeah. I think I circled that too, obviously. Yeah. I mean, there could be the argument made that Lucas's mythos would have drastically evolved the entire franchise, and what they're doing now is kind of tiptoeing around the zeitgeist of the OT, and they're kind of milking it for everything it's got. And it's kind of not a commitment to storytelling, right? Like, you could argue that. I'm not saying I'm arguing that, but just you could argue that there's maybe not a commitment to push things a little further.
I absolutely believe that. I believe it to be true. I think, you know, Lucas would be bold and he wouldn't care what people think. It's not precious to him because it's his.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at it like, if when you keep going the next after that quote, it's like, this realm, as we know from psychoanalysis, is precisely the infantile unconscious. It is the realm we enter in sleep. So I'm like, mm-hmm. I can imagine him being like, oh, there's like dream communicators and stuff. But philosophically, what would you prefer? Would you rather have Lucas doing this crazy micro world with like dream talkers having doing now, which is essentially they're respecting what, you know, the original things.
I think the cerebral nature of the force powers that are now in play kind of pay homage to that.
Yes.
Right. It's kind of like we're going in now. We're going internal for this last trilogy. There's a lot of mind probing. There's a lot of abilities we haven't seen yet
it's
to deal with.
Building on a lot of what we were first introduced to. Yeah, right. Like things that we were first introduced to with the Force. Mm-hmm. Like you go back to like A New Hope, the Force was mostly mental, right? This idea of mind tricks, right? The idea of communication between Obi-Wan, you know, this idea of not super physical. And then you get into like Empire and you get into Return of the Jedi, and there's like, there's telekinesis, there's lightning bolts, there's all these other things, these physical things. So I think you're right, Grant. I think we're kind of going back internal in a lot of ways, which I'm excited
for. Which is fun, yeah.
Yeah. I was reading this, and I'll come back to some of these other ones, that, like, when I was reading this, it was so hard because I'm like, all right, so original trilogy, prequel trilogy, sequel trilogy, Rian Johnson making Last Jedi, and then just 2018. Like, there were quotes in here that I felt like, I'll just read one, which made me super depressed. It's on page 14. Sure. Dream is the personalized myth. Myth is the depersonalized dream.
Yeah.
Both myth and dream are symbolic in the same general way of the dynamics of the psyche. And part of me is like, I feel like the internet has destroyed myth. Meaning that the myth is the depersonalized dream, and all we want, because we're so spoiled through the internet, is a personalized myth, that we all want the story we want. Like that made me read that. I'm like, I literally wrote, in 2018, maybe myth is dead. Like, I just wrote that. Granted, I don't know if I actually believe that, but like, the internet's been dealing with this idea of like, that this mentality of, I want it my way has to be the way it's done, as opposed to like, just tell me a good story that connects to me on a deeper level.
Right. Right.
Connects to everyone on a deeper level.
God, that is depressing. Thanks for that.
You're welcome, guys.
I'll just be scared.
I actually wrote that down too. I said, that same dream is personalized myth, and myth is depersonalized dream. I wrote that down, and I kind of broke it down to, dreams are where things are troubled, and myth is kind of where the solutions are to the psychological disease.
Right.
And catharsis, whatever. But when it comes to fandom, it's kind of like everyone is holding this as their own personalized myth right now. And it's, and I just feel like, you know, you've heard James Mangold make tweet about how writing Star Wars is almost like writing the Bible at this point.
Right, yeah.
And I would say that those are two interesting points to look at in any kind of thesis that's like, who is Star Wars for? And is it helping people, and is it cathartic, and is it a story that's actually going to give us a universal hero at the end that's going to bring about a change and help the people who it's for, right? It's kind of, it's interesting. I don't know where that argument ends. I don't know where that discussion ends, but it's interesting to think about who it's for and what its function is at this point. Because there's a lot of high stakes people who work on Star Wars and who love it and covet it in their own right and know the direction of it. And there's a lot of people who have just lived with it for so long in their lives that, that it's now just a part of their life. And they actually do see it like a religious text at this point. So it's a really interesting dilemma we're at right now that I think is fun to think about.
Yeah.
Is it fun?
It's not fun.
It's fun as Star Wars and Galaxy Spaceships.
It's a fictional Flash Gordon serial kind of.
But thing, I mean, but. From like again, this is not 2018, right? I was watching these movies in the 80s, but Star Wars and Indiana Jones are the two reason I am where I am in my life. And Mom and Dad, I love you. You were so supportive of all my dreams, and so I should give you more credit. But like, I wanted to become a doctor. Because of Dr. Jones. Like, that's why I have a PhD, literally because he was the coolest thing I've ever seen, right? And, like, Star Wars taught me calm. Like, it really did.
Right.
Like, I took to that, like, people take to, you know, Buddhism, right? This idea of, like, I just really, like, had in my mind, like, what would Obi-Wan do right now when I was a kid? Like, that mentor in my head, like, just, like, calm down, relax. Like, that.
Yeah.
That's what I had. And that's a little extreme. I'm not saying everyone who watched Star Wars took those things away from it. But
I did.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Because it's telling the same stories in a different way that we've been told that that myths are there to engage with and learn morals from and learn ethics from and learn.
Yeah, right.
Like, so I feel like Star Wars does that. But anyway.
Yeah. And then when Campbell keeps bringing up Daedalus, I couldn't help but think about Rian Johnson. I couldn't help but think
Rian Johnson.
There's even a sentence that's like
Galen Erso.
Galen Erso. That's in your universe. Yes. I'm just talking about in the meta context that's of the creators.
Right. It's like where are we? Right. What level are we analyzing it? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and there's just interesting lines that were when he discusses Daedalus and defines him. He talks about him being like a diabolical human phenomena dedicated to the merit of his art. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, that's what Rian's doing. He's just trying to build in these moral values into his art, and if people don't like it, there's still lots of lessons in there. There's still lots in the art that's going to teach us at the end of the day. So it's like, yeah, he's going to upset people, but at the end of the day, he sacrificed, you know, everything for the art. And I think that's really, really beautiful and interesting and fun. And I want that to be the future of Star Wars, is to have more people do that.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Can we just go back to Galen Erso for a second?
Sure.
Yeah. Thank you. Because I was like, who is Daedalus in the whole thing?
But, okay, yeah.
But that's totally right.
Yeah.
Like, that just nailed it down. Like he's.
I'll read you a real quick quote where I got to that.
Yeah.
Page 18. The very scientist who, in the service of the sinful king, was the brain behind the horror of the labyrinth, quite as readily can serve the purpose of freedom.
Yeah.
That is Galen Erso, right? Like that. Like clearly, like I'm going to go with the whole psychoanalysis route. They clearly were hitting that archetype, right? Someone who works for the sinful king, the empire, the emperor, but also then at the end, 0 hour, puts the flaw in it, gets the plan, tries to change it, right?
And like, yeah, it is indeed very little that we need, but lacking that, the adventure into the labyrinth is without hope.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like, it's literally that. And he made, like, that's the whole thing. I mean, the labyrinth is
I would argue that Yoda is very much like Daedalus in terms of understanding the labyrinth of thought, the hero of thought, right?
Yeah.
But not giving the answer to the hero. The hero has to rise, the hero's heart has to rise to the occasion, right? That's what Yoda's always been throughout all the stories.
Yeah. And that's what's fascinating about this, right? Because like, there's only so many archetypes and there's so many characters in Star Wars that you're going to see these. And another line that reminded me of is, Daedalus has represented the type of the artist scientist, that curiously disinterested, almost diabolically human phenomenon, beyond the normal bounds of his social judgment, dedicated to the morals, not of his time, but of his art, right? And like, especially when you read some of the prequel or some of the stuff that comes before Rogue One, like some of the books and the comics, seems like Galen Erso in his early days, of just obsessed with the science and just creating without the thought of what he's creating, what harm it will cause. Anyway, but I like that. Like, I like the Yoda thing a lot. Yeah. I didn't think about that, but...
Luke, to a degree, I would argue, a little bit like Daedalus in terms of understanding paths and not showing them to Rey.
And perhaps he's going to be even more so in Episode 9, right? Like, that may be the role he falls into. Yeah.
I don't know how much we should do this, but... just because we've talked a lot about Daedalus, but they go into a long section of the story of King Minos, and he made a bargain with Poseidon, and Daedalus is an architect in this mythos, and he creates the maze that holds the Minotaur, which was created by Ra Thangs, and so by a long hilarious series
yada,
of events,
yada.
Created a wooden cow so that his wife could have sex with a bull, and so on. But over and over again, Campbell uses this maze as the analog or metaphor for the subconscious.
Yeah.
And the minotaurs and the demons that lurk within.
And I'll make another pitch for the listeners to go out and read this along with us, because his writing is dense, but it's very poetic.
It's
beautiful. And when he tells stories, like, he actually takes the time to tell the story. And he writes it in not an academic, dry way at all. He writes it as literature.
Yeah.
Like, it is literature when you're he's retelling that story. Yeah. To the point of, I kept looking to see if it was just a block quote, because it reads like that, but it's own
retelling of the story. Yeah.
And so if you're not familiar with these myths, which, to be honest, it's been forever since I read this myth. Mm-hmm. Like, when I was reading, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. And then she does this with the bull, and that's why there's the Minotaur. And, but, like, you know, it took me a while to get back that you don't have to have any familiarity with these myths to appreciate this book. And it's going to give you a deep dive into, like, mythic literature. I took a mythology class in college, and I'm still, now after reading, I'm like, why didn't you just assign us this book? Like, why is it just this book? This should have been the book that we had to read. This should have been the textbook, because it tells the stories, but also gets to the deeper level of it. Anyway, so worth the read, because we're not going to have time to go and retell every story that he tells.
Yeah.
So either read the book or Google.
Yeah. He parses it along through the chapter. He'll give you little chunks of the story as it pertains to the different the aspects of the hero's journey and the archetypes. And that first archetype, the Minotaur, is kind of like the tyrant monster. I couldn't help but think about the "You're a monster" line from The Last Jedi.
And
Kylo. And is Kylo the monster at the end of the day? Or is it more complicated than that? It's kind of an interesting thing. I don't know why I wrote it down, but then as I read the chapter, it's like, you know, the monster is a hoarder of the general benefit. He has his own tortured psyche. And a lot of the stuff was just ringing clear to be Kylo.
Fascinating.
But it's also more complicated than that, in my opinion. He's not just the monster. He's soul searching for the same catharsis a hero would be.
Right? Yeah.
I would argue. It's interesting. It's a nice evolution of the hero's journey. And I also looked at, like, Luke and Neo from The Matrix and things like that. They're kind of struggling to believe, right? Belief is a big thing. But Rey, it's more about identity. It's so different than the classical, like, hero's journey that they teach in film school, right? Yeah,
she, like, wants to be the hero.
It's a little different.
You know,
and Kylo's a little different in that too.
I just had a weird flash, and I always joke about Kylo with his shirt off that we had referenced earlier.
Ben Solo.
But, like... But he looks like a Minotaur. Like, how broad his chest is. Mm-hmm. Like, literally, you look at the artwork in here of what the Minotaur looks like. Like, he looks like that.
Yeah.
Like, so, like, again, was it conscious or unconscious? Was it not? Is he? And then my mind's now going in a million directions story-wise of, like, wait, does that mean that if they're going that route, is he actually Han Solo's son? Or was there something else that occurred? Like, do you have this weird moments of all these connections? Because if you think about, like, the birth of the Minotaur. Now, I'm guessing you're not going to go literal with the connections. But, yeah, Grant, I never really made that connection. But the second you said Kylo and Minotaur in the same sentence, it just kind of blew open my mind.
That makes a lot of sense. I can't think of him as any other sort of analog in there.
And the labyrinth is just the social, the subconscious divide between Rey and Kylo, right? It's like, where do I find you? And then vice versa, how do I reach you? The other person. It's really, really fascinating. It was also fun that you talk about the hero is directly tied to a self-achieved submission that kind of plays into a riddle.
You're on page 11 right now.
Am I on page 11? Yeah. The hero is directly tied to a self-achieved, like, submission that plays into a riddle towards towards creating something new.
We have to ask ourselves and everything.
And I couldn't help but think about Rey in that moment, where it's like, could Rey be bringing about a new order of thought, a new Jedi order, something new at the end of this? And she kind of, it's perfect. She really does bring in a new mode of thinking that I really, really, really like. And that was a very Rey. After it goes through Tyrant Monster, it goes into the hero, and everything that was mentioned there was totally Rey. So it's like, when you read this first prologue, it's like jarringly obvious that it's Kylo. And it's also the same for Rey when it talks about the hero and talks about the tyrant monster. So I thought that was kind of cool.
I have one, just as the traditional rites of passage used to teach the individual to die to the past and be reborn to the future, so the great ceremonials of investiture divested him of his private character and clothed him in the mantle of his vocation. But I don't know. I mean, that's like literally let the past die, right?
Right.
And then, mm-hmm. I mean, that's what he's done, and that's the case he's trying to make to Rey.
Yeah.
Just like, but I don't, you know, it all depends on if she's going to do. And like right above that, it says the return of the bull should have symbolized his absolutely selfless submission to the functions of his role. Mm-hmm. The retaining of it represented, on the other hand, an impulse to egocentric self-aggrandizement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, he's talking about King Minos there.
Yeah.
But, and the not returning the bull to Poseidon. Mm. But I don't know. Yeah, I definitely feel a lot of Kylo could actually be the
right, because when we talk about the hero, it talks about a hero must die to the past and be reborn to the future. But it's right. We're in discussion about the hero at this point in the book, and it's like that's when you hear that line, that's Kylo,
100%.
Yeah, it's really really interesting.
Which is why we're gonna get a redemption,
right? maybe not though. Maybe not.
We put a bet on this, right?
Yeah, I mean we didn't. Do the terms, but we did.
Let's suss out the terms right now. Let's do them now. What are we gonna? Is it? I think beer would be too getting off too early. I think.
Yeah.
Dinner.
Dinner meal.
Sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
Let's think buy the other two people Blu-rays for $9.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like something like that. Like let's give it some thought. We'll come back with our ideas next week. Yeah, we'll put down some bets on this. Yeah, well, we gotta make some specific notation.
And
about
if you're
this.
Listening, and if you think you can come up with a good bet for us to make mm-hmm. over this, and where you stand, please let us know at SW. Well,
we do have an Instagram account, which means it always means like it should be a weird photo.
I think it's like a he's like feigning this mm-hmm. heroic storyline.
Yeah,
he's totally. He's totally the villain. Like it's interesting to have the villain be think of himself as heroic or as
a
factor of change.
I don't think he thinks he's heroic.
He doesn't.
I think
he's a factor of change.
He's like,
I am
a monster.
He thinks he's a monster, but
he wants to be a monster.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know which one he's lying. Because sometimes it feels like he's lying about.
Yeah.
He's like. He knows what he needs to say to Rey to get on her. It's like, mm-hmm. Oh yes, I'm redeemable.
Yeah.
And you know, I can come around, but he's like, no.
Yeah.
Like there's. He's not that. He's a darker thing.
Yeah. And when it said the hero is directly tied to self-achieved submission, Rey submits to Kylo to get into that throne room with Snoke. It's a submission.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's totally in the book here. Really cool. What else do we have here? What that piece? Tragedy and comedy. Should we move on to the
do the second chapter of the prologue. Yeah
and again, like, we're going to be touching on all these concepts again in every
thing.
This is just the sort of this is just the prologue to
and some I have more notes than others. I don't have a ton of notes in this section
either.
I don't have that much. I just took down things that I kind of like to keep for myself, but Bacchus time. He does mention the Bacchus, which is fun.
And the music of the spheres.
When he talks about amor fati, like the love of fate, I couldn't help but think about Snoke, because Snoke is kind of, and the Emperor to a degree, kind of infatuated with fate and the future, the paths that the future can take.
Love of fate, of fate is inevitably death.
Right.
Of the fate that is inevitably death constitutes the experience of the tragic art, there in the joy of it, the redeeming ecstasy.
Yeah. And he talks about the happy ending for the first time, which is kind of interesting.
Yes.
And he talks about kathados and anodos, which is like downgoing and upcoming, which is kind of the beginning of the journey. You're going going down the path, and you're coming up the path. I would say a great visual representation of this is kind of like Lord of the Rings, right? It's like they're literally walking down a path to go on the adventure, and they're literally coming back up the path to the Hobbiton. It's like really cool.
I saw there was one quote in here where he's talking about the different types of tragedies there are.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is the variously interesting tragedy of democracy, where the god is beheld crucified in the catastrophes, not of the great houses, meaning the rich people, but of every common home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was like, we know that all these movies sort of mirror political climate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that would be the tragedy that I think would probably befit our current state of affairs right now. And I kind of hope they don't do it. Mm-hmm. But that would be the kind of thing, you know, where it's like the First Order convinces people and it's not a resistance.
Right.
The resistance is resisting the people as well as the.
So I kind of go, you know, what I had here, which is interesting, is that, like, original trilogy is a comedy. right? If you trace how it ends. And when you're looking at literature, I think one thing that people, if you haven't read the book and you don't know a lot, like comedy doesn't mean ha ha ha.
No.
Like right. It just means usually has a hopeful ending.
Right.
And that's a very overly simplistic way of looking at it. And the prequel trilogy is a straight up tragedy. Like you look at it, like that's the structure of it.
Yeah.
We don't know. We have a good idea that we're dealing with a comedy when we look at all nine. But we don't know.
So. Yeah.
But I literally have it down here at the very end of page 21. Is the business of mythology proper to reveal the specific dangers and techniques of the dark interior way from tragedy to comedy? Hence, the incidents are fantastic and unreal. They represent psychology, not physical triumphs.
Yep.
And so I have this here. Like, this is why episode 9 has so much riding on it. It really ends up determining whether we're dealing with a tragedy or whether we're dealing with a comedy. I think we're all assuming we're dealing with a comedy, correct? Like, are we?
I hope so. Yeah.
I hope so, because I think so, from like, the get-go, we have BB-8. It's like a small little cute droid geared towards kids. I would not suspect that they're going to have a dark ending.
And then the galaxy trilogy ends.
No, but in terms of, like, yeah, and it's so weird too, because, you know, you're dealing with, after episode 8, I'm less convinced. But the fact that JJ is directing episode 9 makes me think, yes, it's going to be a comedy, but they have to thread that needle, right? Like, they have to bring it back. They have to get all these things done to make sure we hit that end transition into going from a tragedy into a comedy.
Right.
I mean, light and dark will have to continue after 9.
Right.
It's just kind of been, there's been too much exposition about the constant that is light and dark. And I feel like it has to continue, but maybe not through Kylo Ren. I think maybe through a different source. No, I agree with you. And I even, when I read that line, the unreal or dreamlike events a hero goes through must not represent psychological but physical not physical triumphs. I kept thinking about The Last Jedi and kind of people's upset about it. It's like what Ryan was trying to do was trying to create a series of events that dealt with the psychological anxieties and problems of all these characters and not so much give you those physical events and those hurrah moments that kind of play to nothing. It's
right.
That's kind of what he did, and it's something that's, and that's why he says he tried to honor myth more than just give you a bombastic Star Wars film.
And connects a little bit with some of the pushback on the fans, right?
Right.
Like if as some fans wanted, Luke came in not as a Force ghost and just took his lightsaber out and took care of all the walkers and destroyed everything, I'm thinking to myself, in that moment, I would have been on my feet clapping in the theater. 100%, right? I would have been like, yeah, get some.
Yeah, yeah.
And then like an hour later, I would have been like, oh. Like I would have been like, that was shallow, right? Like that was just kind of like a not. Yeah. And so that is, right? That would have been the physical victory as opposed to Ryan really, really, really double down on the psychological victory, right? Which I think is the other way around. When you're in the moment of it, you're going like, what? Like, I'm depressed. And then when you think back on it 3 days later, you're like, oh, actually, that was really uplifting and really kind of beautiful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we did, but I don't know. I'm just trying to play devil's advocate here. If we have to read this book to try and expose it and be like, oh, that's what he was doing, or if it needs to be explained to people, was Rian Johnson effective?
Right. Yeah.
And I mean, all I know is I enjoyed it when I watched it and I wasn't thinking about mythos and like, and how, I mean, but I feel like, I mean, I could empathize with the characters. I see what's going on with Rey. Uh-huh. I understand that her greatest fear is that she's nobody, you know, that, you know, there's nothing going on. She wants she has this thing inside her that makes her feel like she needs to do something important and she wants to be a part of it, not just cast aside.
Right.
Which I think will end up being a really uplifting story when her whole story is done, because I mean, obviously she's quite in the middle of this thing and, you know, I mean, we saw from episode 5 to 6 that Luke really jumped in abilities and became a very confident Jedi. Like, well, how cool would it be if that's the Rey we see?
Yeah.
And, you know, now it's, you know, she's exponentially speeding through all of these abilities. And, like, she's all in black or whatever. You know, dead serious and is leading crazy missions. And she's like a... you know, an almost golden era Jedi in abilities and like her daring and
two things. Sorry, my mind just blew itself.
Please.
First of all, moving past that.
That's Freudian, isn't it?
Very Freudian.
Very Freudian.
But also kind of appropriate because I kind of feel that way. Yeah. So Rey, right? She, what are the odds? She has the sacred texts. like the feeling, my feeling is she's actually going to read them and studying and learn from them that Luke didn't, right? Yeah, this idea of like,
she already knows multiple languages. She'll be able to figure it out.
Right. Mm-hmm. The prequel trilogy starts with a prophecy.
Yes.
Was it a prophecy misread?
Maybe.
Meaning that, is it that, was that Anakin not actually a virgin birth in the way that the prophecy, he was created by midichlorians from the dark side?
Right.
Maybe Rey.
Yeah, you're right.
So maybe Rey is actually the virgin birth that brings balance to the Force. Like, that's the payoff at the end, is that she's the one, right? And so as much as she's no one, quote unquote no one, she is the prophecy.
Yeah, wow. I agree with that.
So these, like, her parents that are dead in a pauper's grave could have just been, I don't know, we found this girl.
Yeah, like she was just, yeah.
Or I mean, right? I mean, if we go to like Christian mythos, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe, I think.
Or that she was born.
Mary was nobody, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Like born in a manger, poor.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, so she was born there.
Yep. Or her Joseph dad was
like, I don't know, you know, maybe it was me, mm-hmm. but like maybe it wasn't. And then.
Yeah,
interesting. Anyway. I love this theory.
Yeah, sorry.
You heard it here first.
And there's
Adam.
There's a transference of a knowledge of the ways, not the Jedi ways, the ways that have evolved, which is, I think it was all caps at some point when I read it in the text here.
Yeah.
But the way is huge, and I think that's interesting because we think about the original Jedi and the rites of passage they had. The initiates were Padawans. It was a whole system, right? And it was kind of this built up
dogma.
And the Jedi doctrine has evolved. It's become mm-hmm. a way now. It's not become the Jedi way. It's just Luke has evolved it. These shamanistic Jedi have kind of evolved the knowledge, and now it's passing on to Rey. And I agree with you, Adam. I think Rey is the chosen one. I think the prophecy was misread ultimately, and I think that's kind of the poetic ending to all of this is that you had to wait for this person. This is the person who's actually going to be to revive the light side of the Force.
Yeah,
thought that was cool. I did think that there's stuff that Ryan kind of doesn't do that part of my gripes, my fixes with The Last Jedi were pertaining to the wise old man and Luke Skywalker. He does show the shining sword to Rey in terms of like teaching her how to appearing at the end and actually drawing his blade, and then he assists her with words to a degree. You know, who the wise old man words are supposed to assist the hero through their trials and tribulations. Right. I did think he could talk to her at the end, and that was kind of my thing, that I was like, maybe he could talk to her at the very end. And I honestly forgot about this chapter, and when I read that over to myself, I was like, that's kind of what was missing for me. It was like just some words at the end to her was the only thing that I felt like was kind of left behind.
So Grant, I'm gonna make your day right now.
Okay, go for it.
You have said this enough times, and you've made this argument enough times that you have converted me.
I've converted you?
I'm officially on board.
Okay, cool.
That I agree that now... So thank you for ruining the end of... No, I'm just kidding. But I agree. Like, I feel like that would have been a poetic moment, especially because we get the end of episode 4. We even we get Ben saying, or we get Obi-Wan saying... Just a couple words to Luke, right?
It's an ADR moment after a shooting day.
Simple. I'm with you. That like, I love The Last Jedi. And so what you said does not reduce my love of that movie. But if that had happened, I say it right now, there was a chance that would have made a run at bumping A New Hope or Empire
just
off my
that
top
one
two
line.
List. Yeah, really? I think that would have, like, I would have cried.
I would have cried that outright at the end.
The catharsis. Yeah. And I think part of what he was going for, not to make excuses for him, because it's been said, like, we have to think, does it connect or not connect, is what we have to look at the end, is that maybe he thought, that's what needs to happen in the next one, right? Yeah. That's a cathartic moment. But it leaves us hanging for 2 years.
For 2 years. Yeah, and I don't know if they can build those feels up again. Like, I see what you're saying now. I just think practically... There was a part of me, I mean, I was looking for missing pixels in the rendering of the sun that Luke was staring at to be like, is that hope on the horizon?
Yes.
Like, I did not want him to be dead.
Yeah.
Right.
And then when he was, like, if you heard his voice, I mean, unless they really literally echoed the way Ben Kenobi's voice.
Yes.
But still, it might have just caused enough confusion. But no, because she's he died, remember?
Yeah.
They flirt
with that in that movie, right? Yeah. When she's saying, like, I feel that he's gone. I feel a sense of loss and purpose, or hope and purpose. I just remember purpose. But, like, so clearly, she still feels him. Like, she still feels that. And so it was just like, and I remember that you're saying, I probably was sitting there in the theater going, Oh, no, credits.
Right.
Like, just waiting for a moment of, like, Luke to say something.
Yeah. And there's a bit of thraldom that comes with, like, a mentor or master character that I think would... It would be nuanced for the mentor to be, no, you know the answers to these problems, and you can do this on your own, and you should trust yourself, because I believe in you now, and I didn't before. Something of that, you know, not verbatim that, but just something of that.
No, but that would have been nice, because, like, Ben, I always call him Ben. When we're talking about the original trilogy, I always think of old man Ben. I never refer to him as Obi-Wan.
Right.
So I have to do that. Stop doing that, A, because he is Obi-Wan, and B, because one of our co-hosts is Ben, so it makes it extra confusing. But when Obi-Wan says, the Force will be with you always, is that very last something thing like he sends? Yeah. Like, I like this idea of not saying that same thing, but, like, trust in yourself always. Like,
always.
This idea of something, like, would have been...
Yeah.
Heartbreaking and meaningful, but
again,
he's back. We know he's back in episode 9, so we're gonna get.
And that's
some...
the thing. It's like we know he's going to be a Force ghost.
Yes.
I think that little bit at the end of The Last Jedi could have shown us what kind of Force ghost he's going to be, and then we could speculate on that for 2 years. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, he's gonna be this. He said that. And like, you know, maybe he's gonna be like this. That's kind of fun. Should we jump to 3? The hero and the god.
Yeah, I got nothing else.
I wrote. So they have a little. They have a circle. With an X, a Y, and a Z around the circle, and I was just like, "Oh, like the way they described it." I was like, "Oh, it's
you can almost do it with every trilogy, and then you can almost do it with the prequel trilogy or the whole trilogy sequels." Like, it's
just the first paragraph is a standard path of the mythological adventure of the hero is a magnification of the formula represented in the rites of passage, separation, initiation, return.
Yes, like it's right there, right?
Yeah, which, like, might be named a nuclear unit of the monomyth.
That's the only thing I underline was separation, initiation, return for like 3 pages because I'm like, yep. Like it's so directly, like clearly connected to Lucas's original trilogy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Other than the great struggle of the Buddha, I underlined that and it tells a little story. And I'm like, is this what Luke did for 35 years between Return of the Jedi and The Force Awakens?
Yes.
How many times did you write down Luke in this section?
Yeah,
a lot.
Yeah.
But no, I have it right there. Assuming the garments of a monk, he moved as a beggar through the world, and during these years of apparently aimless wandering, acquired and transcended the 8 stages of meditation. He retired to a hermitage.
Yeah.
Bent his power 6 more years to the great struggle.
Yep. Yes.
Carried,
keep going.
Carried austerity to the utmost and collapsed in seeming death.
Yep.
Or presently recovered.
Right? Yeah. Like, Rian Johnson, like, come on. Like,
And when Sujata comes with the milk rice, it's similar. And Buddha just throws it away.
Yes.
Yeah,
very lightsaber moment right there. I was like ooh.
There is no doubt that because, of course, Rian Johnson was very, like, when you see him in that making of, he was very cognizant of carrying on Lucas's vision.
Yeah.
Not knowing what Lucas's vision was necessarily or being beholden to it. But, like, that's what any smart filmmaker who's trying to continue a storyteller's story is. Like, what was the source material? What was he going back for? Like, and it's a weird way that this made me appreciate The Last Jedi more. It almost makes me feel similar to The Last Jedi as I did to The Force Awakens to the original trilogy, because The Force Awakens feels like it's cribbing the original trilogy. And now as I read this chapter... And we had texted about this. I'm like, did Rian Johnson just read this chapter and write a movie? Is this not as deep as I thought that movie was? Like,
that was literally my text message. Too,
Joseph Campbell's family sue him? No.
I know. It was almost like he's like, God, that's a dense book. But you know what? I got a lot out of that first chapter.
Yeah, 30 pages, like, plenty to go on.
It's more than I could ever read.
More than I ever could really put in there.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. So when we get to the Buddha story and we talk about the when Buddha sits under the Bo tree and Kamamara, the demon comes, obviously we thought of, I think...
Oh, Kamamara.
I think we thought of... Mara, right? And then I think we thought of Kylo and Luke, right? In The Last Jedi when Kylo sends all these different... It has all the ATM-6s fire on Luke and it's basically a metaphor for the spinning blade of of Kamamara. But... It says Kamamara. Obviously, Kamamara is represented as a male god, I believe.
Yeah.
But Mara Jade from the extended universe clearly looks like it's borrowing from the Kamamara scenario. And it even says the Kamamara is a... Kamamara represent? Like unbridled lust and
the
like
god of
passion.
Love and death.
Love and death. Okay. Yeah. Love and death. Very interesting. Are we missing a like dark female character in the end of the Star Wars saga, Skywalker saga?
Maybe.
Yes.
Like Abeloth or Mara Jade. Are we missing that kind of angle?
I would love to see
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I think 100%. Okay. Like, okay. I think you're right on. I mean, like, that's, like, I didn't know we were missing it until you mentioned that. Like, yeah, this is exactly what we're missing. Like, you think about, well, Kerry Russell.
Who knows? Yeah, I would, just talking about what we talked about at the beginning of this, with the rumors of her and Kylo interacting for a, you know, an extensive scene. I mean, she would be a great Knight of Ren. You know, like one of these rogue people that is maybe ascending through his ranks, and he's trying to, you know, maybe he's doing like a dark Jedi order, you know?
No, that would be really cool.
That would be something great if it's like suddenly we have this league of Dark Force Jedi, you know, Jedi users, and she was one of them. But I mean, she would be Kamamara. I mean, we're talking about the god of love and death. She would have, she would be a massively powerful character.
Yeah, like, and maybe that's what continues. This is going to hit a little more on my redemption thing, or like, or actually may play into your non-redemption argument. But maybe she's the temptress, right? This person, she discovers a dark side user or someone on the dark side, because that's all he wants is to be dark, even though light keeps pulling him, that he finds this, and he, instead of like chasing after Rey, he decides to chase after this person who's dark side, and and kind of feeds into that energy.
Yeah.
And JJ was even talking about making Snoke a woman before was a man.
Oh, that would have been fascinating.
Really cool. Yeah, he would have gotten that kind of like Edward White Witch thing from like Narnia, right? Mm-hmm. He would have kind of been like that in an interesting way, which would have been kind of fun.
I couldn't remember what the candies...
Yeah, neither can I. Turkish Delights.
Turkish Delights. So I was like, what would be the Turkish Delights then in the movie? And then I couldn't get to the joke because I couldn't think of what, like, couldn't think of Turkish Delight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is not pleasant if you ever had it before.
Yeah, but I looked at that, and I looked at the poetic ideas behind Mara Jade. And I thought that was so beautiful. I really didn't look at Mara Jade in the light of Kamamara and thinking about Luke and thinking about this love and death god.
Really. I don't speak whatever language this is, but if Kamamara is the god of love and death, and I'm pretty sure the comma is love, Mara might actually mean death.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty cool name.
Which, again, for me, look at the old canon, right? And you look at the old, like, when they're naming things, it's pretty clear that they were looking at literary things to name dark side users, right? Like Darth Maul, Darth this, Darth that. And I know Mara Jade was never a Darth, but you know, she was the Emperor's hand for a long time, Force user, a dark Force user, right? So it makes sense that they went with that to kind of like in the naming.
But the Buddha story is almost done scene for scene in The Last Jedi, because especially when Brahma comes in and tells Buddha to go on and teach others the way of knowledge that he's learned after this experience. That's Yoda. That's the Yoda.
That's the fascinating thing, right? Is like there's not like, exactly.
It's a complete overlap.
It's just right there. Yeah.
I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah.
And good work, Ryan, for doing that. That's really cool.
Yeah. But seriously, if you don't add any other references for the rest of this book, I'm calling you out.
Right? Like, yeah.
for being lazy.
Yes. Like, you read a paragraph.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. That's pretty great, though. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so...
But he is doing, like, to kind of back up, but jokingly, but he is doing what George did, right? This idea of, like, telling... It's fascinating because he's telling a story... Mm-hmm. That is the foundation of a religion.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, he's retelling that in this. And there was not this huge connection.
No.
Like, as much as people love that movie, like, it is not like this is not going to be the clarion call that...
No, we just get clickbait articles about the issues with production, with casting. It's so surface. Society is like, we wonder why we have the president we have. We only think about surface details when it comes to almost everything.
So that's my question. Was the internet or was it Western versus Eastern society? Does that make sense? Like, is there something like bias in our very Western-y feelings about? Mm-hmm. But I guess, you know what? I'm going to back off of that immediately because Campbell would say no, because it's the monomyth. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, so like I just talk about myself, it doesn't matter. Like that's a story that should, so it is the internet's fault.
Yeah.
Right.
All right, asked and answered.
Yes. Actually to most thing it is the internet's fault.
Mm-hmm. We're old and blaming the internet.
Yeah. I had a couple other just little like short one off things. We've been talking about how they tell the story of Buddha and the Bodhi tree. In the beginning of the story, he sets forth secretly from his father's palace on the princely steed Kenthaka. And I was just like, Millennium Falcon?
Oh, Lord. That's stretch, but I love it.
But I'm like, it's just funny that he's he had to mention the steed. And and I was like, oh, that's probably a thing.
Right. Again, if we're going with the psychoanalysis rules, George Lucas, that's why he named the Millennium Falcon the Millennium Falcon without realizing he was naming the Millennium Falcon that. That, like, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it right. was a subconscious, unconscious
thing. Like, they need a trusty steed to ride away on. Yep. And that is how you would describe that. And then also there was another quick note in that one, Kamamara. So Kamamara throws everything at Buddha to try and distract him from his meditating and you know, reaching, which he cannot do. But and at first he tried to tempt him, like, mentally with women and all this other stuff. And then they just straight up fought. He had, like, a 1,000 legions. People, but his weapon is he flung his razor sharp discus angrily, and I was just like, I just imagined, like, a light discus or something, like some sort of like some weapon, like discus shaped. Like, I would not be surprised,
like a spinning lightsaber.
yeah. I mean, almost. Oh, yeah. I mean, it could be like the.
But that we're talking
interrogators
about,
or the what are they called?
The Royal Guards.
Inquisitors?
Oh, Inquisitors. Okay. The Inquisitors weapon. It could be that, but I don't know. I just thought, like, maybe there'd be some other sort of weapon, and it would not be surprise me if in 9 we saw, you know, a Knight of Ren or something throwing, like, a weapon that was actually discus and came back or something.
I'm now, this is a little off track and I won't go deep, but everyone ever read the Dark Tower series by Stephen King?
I didn't read it.
Yeah, I love it. It's one of my favorite things. So much of this is connecting to me with that as well. Like, there's a discus weapon in that where I'm just like, oh, come on, Stephen King. You're also not creative. No.
I thought about that a lot in here too, because, you know, Stephen King took this whole monomyth and was like, I'm going to put a Western in between all space and time.
And then include, like, medieval stuff, too. Yeah, like, I'm sorry. I'm a big fan of that whole series. And it gets so weird at the end. So crazily, funnily weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's like, I'm just going to crank out a exact copy of Seven Samurai.
Yep.
And then I'm going to I'm going to write myself into a book. And then I'm going to, like, break this whole wall.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to, like, bite Harry Potter, but put all the characters I've ever written about to date in my book. Like, it's insane.
It's great. It's amazing.
However, Wolves of the Kala, that, like, I mean, talk about monomyth. Like, Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. It, like, it doesn't matter how many times that story is retold.
No.
It's amazing.
And so good. Yeah. And he just takes one book in this giant thing to just be like, you know, we're not going to advance the overall story much. We're just going to tell a really wonderful and fun, important tale for 400 pages.
Yeah. Exciting. We'll talk about this offline. But did you see Win Through the Keyhole? Which is the same thing. It was just a joy to read.
I just bought the whole series on in book form and like, just now it's all done, and they include that in the whole thing. And I'm like, I gotta do a reread, but then it's like takes up half a bookshelf.
So that could be my favorite. That could be my favorite story, and it's
the
story that's the whole thing. Anyways, Stephen King.
Yeah, check him out if you don't know who he is. Research.
If
you never heard of him.
Yeah. But he also, I mean, everyone borrows from this technically, whether they know they're doing it or not.
Right. Yeah.
So super.
Yeah. And then towards the end of the chapter, it gets kind of into summarizing where it's going for the rest of the book.
Yeah.
And I know we don't want to break apart too much of this because we're going to read these individual chapters, but I'm going to do that for a moment because I'm going to soapbox here for a minute, a little bit, because on page 29, when it's talking about the trials and victories, the chapter 2. So I'm going to say this because we'll forget this when we deal with this in 6 weeks. But they talk about the return and reintegration with society part.
Right.
And mentions 3 possible ways it could happen.
Yep.
And to me, this explains... The reason why I want to talk about this now is because I'm talking about this explains The Last Jedi almost completely and explains fan reaction to The Last Jedi. Because there's 3 options the way this is going to run. The first is... the hero himself may find the most difficult requirement of all. For if he has won through to the profound repose of complete enlightenment, there is danger that the bliss of this experience may annihilate all recollection of interest in or hope for the sorrows of the world, or else the problem of making known the way of illumination to people wrapped in economic problems may seem too great to solve. That's Luke in The Last Jedi, right? Like, he's completely separated himself. He's been overwhelmed by the enlightenment that he sought, right?
Right.
So, second.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah. On the other hand, if the hero, instead of submitting to all the initiatory tests, has simply darted to his goal and pluck the boon for the world that he intended, then the powers that he has unbalanced may react so sharply that he will be blasted from within and from without. So to me, this is the Return of the Jedi. Luke has no training. He has almost no training. He defeats the Emperor. Mm-hmm. He has snatched the boon of victory without much in the way of trial. And Snoke is this part. The powers that he has imbalanced may react so sharply that he's be blasted from within, from without. Right? It's right. That idea of being blasted, like that idea that he imbalances it because he cheats in a way that he
does. Yeah, and they talk about this throughout this whole section. Mm-hmm. Is that sort of there's a couple ways for the hero to obtain his, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more later, but to obtain his goal, and one is to sort of like do the legwork, do the work, suffer through the trials, you know, really solve this maze within your subconscious and become a better person and then evolve. Other way is just reach in and grab it.
Yeah.
And go.
Yeah.
And just like do it. And, and this is, and they liken that to what Prometheus did, where he stole fire, spire, and gave it to mortals. Yeah.
And I kind of argue that's Luke in a little way.
That is kind of Luke.
Mm-hmm. In the original trilogy, because all of his mentors are gone, and then he decides, and also compared to what he talked about in The Force Awakens, well, talked about in The Last Jedi, is like, and then I just decided with my hubris to start a training academy, right, without having any guidance, really.
Yeah.
Sorry, Grant, what were you going to say?
I was going to say the first outcome pertains to The New Hope. The second, Prometheus, is An Empire Strikes Back. And the final one is more like Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Because in the last one I had, this is basically his building the Jedi Academy. So it's like the Return of the Jedi leading into... Yeah, no, I think that's a good way to look at it. Mm-hmm. That's the thing, like as we were talking about, we have multiple...
Because he just goes to face Vader in Empire. He just rushes...
Yeah.
Quick device. Yes. Luck. Just tries to get it done and fails.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like Prometheus, right? Very Promethean. So.
But that's the thing. Like, it's interesting when we read these because we have multiple circles of storytelling, like individuals, with I said individual movies, trilogies, and then the overall trilogy. Anyway, so
interesting.
So I won't talk too much about the rest of the summaries, but I just read that and I kept going, like, this reminds me of, like, all the possible Lukes we get in the six movies that we have them in.
No, very cool. Do we want to do an overview of the stages of the hero's journey, or do we want to just save it for as we go through it?
Why don't we do an overview?
Yeah, sure.
Grant?
All right, sure. Why not? So first is the call to adventure or signs of the vocation of the hero. Refusal of the call, supernatural aid, the crossing of the first threshold, the belly of the whale. Then the stage of trials occurs, or initiation, and then the road of trials. The meeting with the goddess, the woman is the temptress, the atonement with the father, apotheosis, the ultimate boon, and then finally we come to the final stage of it, which is the return, and that is the refusal of the return, the magic flight, rescue from without, the crossing of the return threshold, master of two worlds, and freedom to live, and we'll be covering all that in the subsequent weeks ahead.
Yeah, and like some of these you can just see, just even from their titles, you're like, this is clearly this moment. And others will be, it'll be interesting to see, kind of trying to find. Some are going to be so directly connected, and others are going to be a little more obfuscated.
I kind of want to jump to a sentence I read on page 30, which was talking about the difference between fairy tales and myths.
Go for it.
Typically, the hero of the fairy tale achieves a domestic microcosmic triumph, and the hero of the myth, a world historical macrocosmic triumph. Whereas the former, the youngest or despised child who becomes the master of extraordinary power, prevails over his or her personal oppressors, the latter brings back from his adventure the means for the regeneration of his or her society as a whole. And I thought that was just really, really interesting because I've heard a lot of people discuss Star Wars as both myth and fairy tale. Mm. And thinking about, and then seeing the divide between Kylo and Rey, I think we may be seeing the mixture of both myth and fairy tale coming together in the sequel trilogy, which is really fun.
That's
cool. Yeah, it's really, really cool. That's a really cool idea.
All I had on my in the margins is Star Wars a fairy tale or a myth? Question mark.
So, right. And JJ says fairy tale.
Yeah.
And Ryan has said myth over and over again.
Yeah.
Think about that for a second.
Awesome.
Yeah, really cool. Really, really cool.
And one thing I'll say is, again, I'm Last Jedi obsessed because it's the last one, but when we look at that, when we look at that discussion, and so they name those two different heroes, right? Mm-hmm. And so the first is known as a tribal or local hero, the one like the hero of a fairy tale,
right?
And then a universal hero is the hero of myth.
Yeah.
And so I have written here, Luke and pretty much everyone else sees himself as a universal hero at the end of Return of the Jedi, right? He has defeated the Emperor. He's defeated the Empire. He's going to start a Jedi. And then I think after the failure at the Trading Academy, he actually redefines himself as a local or tribal hero.
Yes.
Then when he reflects back on his life, he goes, 100%. No, actually, it's all about me and becoming my story and defeating my father or bringing my father back. And, you know, this idea, so I thought that was really fascinating.
That's really cool.
And I think that works when you have half of the people making the story saying it's a fairy tale and the other half saying it's a myth. Like, you can play with those themes, which is really fun.
So the outcome of Luke's journey in episode 8, we would all agree, is a fairy tale in terms of how it plays with the Rebels.
Yeah,
and I not the entire galaxy. Yes. I guess it does play with the galaxy as a whole, though.
Yeah, I think it's going to. I think what we're going to get is a little, like, dip. We're going to get myth in the fairy tale back in the myth.
Right, like, it's a fairy tale. We witness a fairy tale, and then it plays as a myth in 9 because everyone learns about it.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely feel like it's not. I mean, it's literally becomes mythic.
It is.
Yes. I mean, in the movie, they're like, and then the myth happened, and these are the people telling the myth to each other.
True, yeah. Yeah, I forgot about that epilogue. Oh.
Yeah, I mean.
Oh, I like that epilogue even more now.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Cool. I mean, there's literally myth in it.
Which I got. Like, I got that at that level, but connecting it back to this idea of, like, of that moment of, like, and I think Ryan was very self-aware of that, this idea of, like, now we got to bring it back to, now we just spent this whole movie looking at these characters and really doing a very focused fairy tale-like story, even though he would call it myth, which is funny. Mm-hmm. He knew he had to bring it back to, like, now we're back to myth level.
Yeah.
Go, JJ. Yeah.
Go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Kind of continues with an overview, and he gets to, he talks about the Virgin, the cosmogonic cycle, emanations, the virgin birth, all these kind of interesting ideas. But then he jumps to this idea of the king's son, and I'll read this out. I'll say he or she because it just says he only, and I think it's unfair that it's
written in 1940.
I would say he or she is the king's son or daughter who has come to know has entered into the exercise of his proper power. God's son or daughter, who has learned to know how much the title means. From the point of view, the hero is symbolic of that divine, creative, and redemptive image, which is hidden within us all, only waiting to be known and rendered into life. And I want to pose this question with you guys. So I call this kind of the king's daughter approach. And I say...
I will note that you added God's son or daughter. That was your own addition in there, too.
I think I have to, because it's just... unfair to talk about it from a male point of view. Too, yeah, exactly. So we're talking about Rey here. And I would call this the king's daughter approach, which is, you know, if Rey is of a special lineage or symbolic of, which would be symbolic of her own discovery therein and our discovery therein of our own kind of power that we're born to or I guess a redemptive image for us. Would it not just be a metaphor for that redemptive image that's hidden for us? And do we really have to think of it as exclusionary or kind of discourteous to people from all walks of life? Like, is that such a problem that she would come from a special bloodline that they wouldn't do it? You know what I mean? Like, if it's a metaphor, I don't see the problem, really.
Well, yeah. I mean, this explains it, right? It's like, you know, yes, there's literally God's son who goes out and is like, you know, has the power. But, like, they're saying that there's... other people, it's hidden within us all.
Right.
And she's the latter, you know? And like, I think they're just trying to be like, yeah, sometimes you're a Skywalker, but that the Force, you know, which is, I think, a metaphor for all religion and the powers therein and a myth, and she has it within herself. And then, they, you know, it can be anyone. And
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, right? Because I think back to my reaction to the original trilogy when I was a kid, and I think I connected most to Star Wars, like to A New Hope, because if you think about at that moment, Luke is just a kid, right? It's just someone in the galaxy who's a nobody who suddenly finds his power within. Yeah. And there's references to his father, but we don't really know anything about that. And the second one, it's still there, but at the end we get Darth Vader. And then the third one's all about, like, no, I have to redeem my father, and the reason why I'm so powerful is because I'm my father's son.
Yeah.
Which is somewhat exclusionary, right? Like, from a kid's perspective. And, you know, we can get into a whole discussion about inclusion and exclusion.
Yeah.
So, you know, was not even to start bringing in gender, race, creed, all that stuff, right? In terms of like, right. does that
exactly.
narrow off? But it is an interesting question, Grant. I don't have a good answer.
Because I mean, it's a metaphor for the redemptive image, which is hidden within all of us.
Right.
It's not so much that, oh, she's of a royal bloodline that's right. unattainable for me. I'm just from, right. you know, this Fifth Avenue right. apartment block. It's, you know, life is not great for me. I'm not, you know, in a monarchy or attached to a bloodline that's of any kind of importance. I don't think it plays to that. I think what Campbell's saying right here is it's just strictly a metaphor. It's strictly like the same redemptive images in all of us. We just have to find it. And I don't understand the argument to not make her someone more important. A pseudo heir to the Skywalker line, a Vader reincarnation, something that I think would probably quell the fan base is like kind of
So you want her to be somebody.
I do in the Campbellian sense. I don't in the kind of the social construct sense that everyone's thinking about.
Like, we're witnessing.
I don't like that.
Yeah. I'm kind of the same way. Like, it wouldn't bother me necessarily, and I don't think it is exclusionary. But from a storytelling standpoint, I don't need someone else to be a Skywalker.
Yeah, okay.
Does that make sense? Yeah, that's the other reason why I'm okay with her being no one is not necessarily bringing it to Campbell or myth. It's just a personal choice of like. Yeah. I think it's going up its own. You know what? A little bit when it keeps referring back to itself so much, and if it's suddenly like this is. But I do like the idea, and we've talked about it before, of the reincarnation thing, because this is at least a different take on it, right? Yeah. Like, it's a different way to do it.
I think what you're talking about has happened already. It's sort of like in the original trilogy, you know, there was the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, you know, like, and it happened, and it just can't, it doesn't need to happen again. I think this is the next logical instance.
Cool.
You know, they don't need to, you know, I see what you mean. Like, you want to witness a myth. You want to see what myth on in a movie, I feel like. Like, you want these movies to actually be the myth themselves.
I don't want that. I think the fans do. I think the fans want a connection to the Skywalkers that's really, really big and pivotal and a massive reveal. And the whole movie hinges on it. And it's crazy.
As long as it's not a direct bloodline connection.
Yeah.
That's my only caveat in the way. Like, I don't want some retconning where she's... I mean,
you know, and we talked about this before, she can be Skywalker's adoptive daughter, even from beyond the grave. You know, like,
Or Skywalker can become like a moniker for somebody who leads the new Jedi Order or temple or something.
Yeah. The new Skywalkers, that's my
I don't know.
Well, instead of Jedi, they call them Skywalkers.
Yeah, right. No, it's this idea. Like, Yeah.
That could be cool. Finally, I'll just read out this last sentence. Because it plays to that unity idea that I kept spouting in the past three podcasts in a row. I was like, I really like unity to pop up as the title in one of these movies.
Oh, yeah.
At the very end, he goes, the two, the hero and the ultimate god, the seeker and the found, are the understood as the outside and the inside of a single, self-mirrored mystery, which is identical with the mystery of the manifest world. The great deed of the supreme hero is to come to the knowledge of this unity in multiplicity and then to make it known. Which was like a beautiful ending kind of note there. It was really, really pretty. But that's the yin-yang, right? That's kind of the never-ending multiplicity
really
duality.
Beautiful.
It's really, really crazy.
I mean, Star Wars Episode 9, the unity in multiplicity. Seems a little heavy, but...
Are we locking it down? Are you locking that down? Yeah.
What? No, not yet. I'm just kidding. I'm just playing with it, just seeing how it tastes on the old tongue.
Yeah.
That's all I got, by the way.
There is the fourth book chapter, but I'm just like...
It's called the World Navel, which is... I don't know. It's just sort of like, and also...
Also this.
Then is ubiquitous. And the World Navel, then, is ubiquitous. And since it is the source of all existence, it yields the world's plentitude of both good and evil. It's sort of like... It's the Force. Yeah. The World Navel is the Force.
Yeah, and that's all. And I don't have a ton...
That's what I have. I'm like, the Force? Question mark?
I have balance? Question marks? Or like, it's just clearly, he read this, and this is just the Force. Like, I know it feels like we're rushing, but I read this chapter, like, twice. This is the only one I read over twice to try to pull stuff out of it. I'm like, the Force.
I had to read it a thousand times.
It's like the outpouring of energy that's responsible for the magical world, usually, right?
Yeah.
Or the world, it's the manifest world.
And he does come back a little bit to comedy and tragedy, but nothing we haven't said before. So, I don't have a lot. I actually don't have anything other than that. So I think that's good for me.
I mean, he talks about with Navel sort of, it's a point, it's a doorway, it's a passageway. God is the doorway. Right. God is this doorway into this, I don't know. Into this other world where the Force comes from.
Yeah.
And it's also wherever a hero has been born, has wrought, or has passed back into the void. Mm-hmm. The place is marked and sanctified. A temple is erected there to signify and inspire the miracle of perfect centeredness. For this is a place of the breakthrough into abundance. Someone at this point discovered eternity. I mean, that's Octo, right?
Yeah.
A nexus of the Force, right?
And I mean, there's that could be any sort of one of these Force temples that they have all over the place. And I mean, that's literally what happened in Rebels, right? Where they had that time nexus. It was was the window into.
Yeah.
My mind during this chapter kept going back to Rebels and Clone Wars. Very Filoni. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like this was a very Filoni read a lot of this stuff too. Yeah. And we got very in the metaphysical aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the opening at the top of the lodge or the crown, pinnacle or lantern of the dome is the hub or midpoint of the sky, the sun door through which all souls pass back from time to eternity.
Yeah, totally, right? Yeah.
And when it says the world navel then is ubiquitous, and since it's the source of all existence, it yields the world's plenitude of both good and evil.
He also tells another, and actually he quotes this one, but there's another story about Edshu, who's the trickster, a West African trickster divinity, who causes a riot with a hat.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. My note was Ryan. I'm like, Ryan Johnson was like, I'm going to hit you.
because he was sort of like,
you see it this way, but you see it this way. Isn't that funny? Ha ha ha. Of course you would think that because I showed you different angles. But I don't know.
Also, what a great and disturbing and depressing story.
Yeah.
I read over that story twice. I'm like, oh, that just describes humanity to a T. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. I was like, oh, yeah, it's too real.
Yeah. Right?
He wears a hat, and like one person's like, it's green, the other one says it's red, because like on one side of the hat it's red and the other side it's green.
Yes. And then they end up just beating
and they're like, you know,
no,
I believe in this so wholeheartedly that I'm gonna fight you on this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound like anything you've run across on the internet in the past 18 months?
Doesn't explain our political climate at all. Okay. What? Huh?
All right, well, super duper. Didn't even mention Orange Cheeto once.
No.
So cool. So next week we will talk about
chapter one
departure.
It's about 40 pages.
Right.
Yeah.
So that'll be great. And I'm gonna start reading that early as opposed to trying to do it in one chunk a day before we have this podcast. But that was really cool. I hope you guys enjoyed it, and we'll sort of, I think this is going to mature as it goes on. I think I'm going to probably focus on really just the Star Wars stuff and really just sort of try and pull out the golden Star Wars nuggets.
Yeah. And I think it kind of lends itself to that the way it goes from here, because it is about the story itself. Right.
This first chapter was very overarching. Yeah. It's like, this is what we're about. This is, you know, it's trying to explain that there is one myth that it can be passed through all others. So
I think my goal when I'm reading these chapters is I'm going to break the three trilogies apart and look at what reflects to the prequel trilogy, what reflects to the original trilogy, what reflects to the thing, and then, because I've been harping on this a lot, what reflects to the overarching nine-part series. Now, granted, we don't know what the ninth one is, but it's just that I think that shouldn't hit or shouldn't affect us until we get to the second part of the book.
Right, and it's going to be sort of interesting because, I mean, the hero's journey, I feel like there's a hero's journey within one movie.
Movie, yeah.
There's a hero's journey within one trilogy. Yes.
And there's a hero's journey within the whole three trilogies. At times.
Yes. Yeah, you can really just go all the way.
Like, so, I mean, it'll be interesting to sort of break that down and figure it out.
Oh, yeah.
So get ready for a six-hour podcast next week.
Hopefully not. Yeah, that was awesome. Thanks for listening to this and bearing with us. We're trying to do something sort of different and exciting. And I don't know. Hope you liked it. Thanks for listening. And may the Force be with you.